Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's a great bit of kit. Seriously, it is. I'm a big fan of this. Really am. I love it. I use it multiple times a day. I also love them because they sponsor our new online magazine called Curious. If you want to have a read of that, please go to lovejoy.co.uk. Have a look. I'm sure you will love it. I'm so sure you'll love it. I want you to feedback. It's articles basically from the podcast where I've talked to all these experts, regular listeners. If you're a new listener, hello. But if you're a regular listener, you will know that. I'm always discussing stuff with the experts. And so what I decided to do is share all the information again, kind of like a reminder of what the experts have said, sharing their wisdom. So it's stuff on health and fitness, negotiating through life, all the other things that I've talked about on these podcasts. I think nearly 300 episodes of this now. So there's also original content on there too. There's the books that have changed my life or impacted my life. I can't remember the last time I counted because I made it to list them. I think it's about 30 books, but they're not all in one. I'm doing one a week. And this week it's a book called Lying, which had an absolutely huge impact on me and changed the way I lived. So I write about it and just my thoughts on it. Please have a look. And as I say, please feedback to me what you think, even if it's to say it's rubbish. Tim, I read it and it's rubbish. Even if you think that, let me know. But if you're going to say it's rubbish, can you tell me why it's rubbish? I don't think you will think it's rubbish, by the way. But if you do, you might as well go, it's rubbish because. Email tim@lovejoy.co.uk. That's tim@lovejoy.co.uk, and let me know. Today I'm curious about what children can teach us about philosophy. Well, in fact, I'm just curious about philosophy. I love a bit of philosophy. Not the philosophers, even though I like philosophers, but I'm interested in philosophy. Joining me is Scott Hercevich, who is Director of Law and Ethics Program and Professor of Law and Philosophy Art at the University of Michigan. He's written a book called Nasty, Brutish and Short, Adventures in Philosophy with Kids. I do love this book, actually. I can't put it down. When I got picked, it's one of those ones, I picked it up and I just, a few weeks ago, he came on Sunday brunch and I was talking to him. We ended up doing the trolley thought experiment, which I'm sure we'll get into at some stage during this. But yeah, it's all there. All these, I'll let you explain. I'll let him explain, sorry, not you. I will let Scott explain what his book is about. Here he is. Let's meet him. Here's Scott. Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Good. I just mentioned that you were on my show, my TV show, not so long ago. Did you enjoy that experience?
I did. It was my first time doing live TV, and it was a blast.
Oh, do you know what? I loved having you on. Thing is, what happened was this conversation about the trolley experiment, which I'm sure we'll get to later, it carried on all through that day. And then it carried on a WhatsApp group between us all the next day and the day after. So I said to you on the show, when it comes to things like philosophy, you can just those sort of thought experiments, everyone loved them. And people kept tweeting at me and saying, what about this? And what about that? And what about they're really good, those little experiments, aren't they?
Yeah, they're kind of like earworms, like the songs that get stuck in your head. It's just like these questions get stuck in your head and you can't get them out.
You're back in America now. You just told me you're in Ann Arbor. That's up in, obviously, Michigan, because that's where you're based. Is it a good place to live up there?
Oh, lovely. Yeah. College town with a lot going on because of the university. Terrific.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start by talking about the book and how it came about. Then we'll get a bit more into you. So, Nasty, Brutish and Short, Adventures in Philosophy with Kids. By the way, I've got to say, I'm a few weeks away from having read this, so it's all a bit sketchy in my mind. But when I did read it, I couldn't put it down because I loved the concept. Explain it to us.
So the idea is to look at some of the major questions in philosophy through the eyes of kids. And I think there's really two reasons for doing that. One is kids are really fantastic philosophers, and a lot of the adults in their lives are missing that fact about them. Like, they arrive in the world and they're just puzzled by everything. So they ask great questions and they challenge things grownups take for granted. And then they try to answer their own questions. And sometimes they're really creative in the way that they do it. And they're really clever about it. Like, you know, I over and over again in the book tell stories of little kids hitting on ancient arguments that people have been making for thousands of years. So that's one reason to look at philosophy through the eyes of kids. The second is they just make the topic fun and funny. So if you've been away from like the philosopher that was inside you for a while, like thinking with kids is a way of recapturing some of that wonder at the world and having some fun.
Yeah, that's so good. I keep on, you've made me do it even more. I do have long conversations with my 9-year-old daughter. But I can't remember what the question was. I remember it was a few days ago. And I just said to her, why do you think that? And she goes, I don't know. I'm asking you why. And I said, no, but I'm asking you. And she goes, you're the adult. You answer it. And I went, no, that's not the answer. Let's talk it through. Yeah. And then she sat and talked it through. And her experience was very valid. It was really interesting the way she thinks about life.
Yeah, well, and you've hit on one of my favorite parenting hacks, which is to say, like, kids, they use why like a weapon. They're just like, why, and they're pushing you past your ability to explain or just trying to drive you crazy. But I think you can, like, flip the game around. Ask them why, make them make the argument. Don't let them get off easy by saying, no, like, this is what I think, or that's what, or you should tell me the answer. Really push them to think it through, because they're more than capable if you push them.
And the great thing about kids is they're not scared to have opinions where adults are, because I know your kids sometimes say, what's the right answer? And obviously there isn't one, but adults think they should know the right answer. So they're scared to offer up differing opinions and stuff or talk it through in case they look stupid.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I think kids make really phenomenal philosophers, which is that, like, they're not afraid of seeming silly. Like, silly is the business they're in. They're not obsessed with, like, whether they might be wrong and whether people might think badly of them because they're wrong. Like, especially, like, sort of pre-adolescence, they don't even care very much what other people think about them at all. So, like, these things just aren't even on their horizon. And then, like, I think one of the reasons we all start to lose it a little bit, like, or lose our aptitude for philosophy, lose our interest in philosophy, is because we do start to worry that we're going to sound silly if we're asking questions like, am I dreaming my entire life?
Yeah. Well, what I love about doing this podcast and my later years now is I've spent a lot of time thinking about these questions, and I've had my mind change so many times. Like, I'm sure you'll change my mind on something today, which is, and it's so fantastic to actually, if you're open, to have your mind change. You're like, oh, I didn't think about it like that. And so it's so lovely listening to the conversations you're having with your children, because they sometimes put arguments forward that I would. And then they might, some of my opinions might be childish sometimes, you know, and then there's more nuance to it. Just getting back to you, how did you first, I know we discussed this on the show, but remind my listeners, how did you first find philosophy?
So I found philosophy by accident. I was, registering for classes as a first semester student at the University of Georgia, and I wanted to take an introduction to psychology, and it was full. And so I was flipping through the course catalog looking for something that would fulfill a requirement that you needed to graduate, and introduction to philosophy fulfilled a requirement. And so I signed up. I thought, well, I'll just get that out of the way. And by the end of the first day, I just thought, this is amazing. Like, these questions are super interesting. The professor's super interesting. My classmates are saying the smartest things I've ever heard. I want to keep hanging out here. And I never left.
Why did you get into law? Are they hand in hand?
So, you know, there's a professional, football player, American football player over here who had been a philosophy major as an undergrad. And he once said in an interview that, he didn't become a philosopher because you can't open a philosophy factory. And I think I had a bit of that worry when I was an undergrad. I thought, oh, like, I really like doing this, but it's really hard to get a job as a philosopher. And you may not make much money doing it. So I'm going to go off and become a lawyer. And then just like by luck, I won a scholarship to go to Oxford, and I got to study philosophy there. And I realized, like, actually there's this field, philosophy of law, where you're asking philosophical questions about law. You're doing it often in a law school where you get paid better than the philosophers do, and you have a lighter teaching load. And so sometimes I feel like I found a loophole in life. I get to be a philosopher with some of the advantages of being a lawyer.
Oxford in here, over here in England.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. What was that like for an American to come here and do that?
Oh, it was an amazing experience, partly because Oxford has been kind of ground zero for philosophy in the 20th and 21st century. It's just got one of the biggest, best communities, and especially for somebody interested in the questions I'm in, philosophical questions about our legal practices, most of the most influential philosophers of law over the last 100 years were faculty at Oxford. So it was great intellectually, and then I just loved I love England. I loved being there and getting to travel around England. And then also, I had never really left the country until then. So, you know, I was hopping on my cheap Ryanair flights and exploring all of Europe. It was terrific.
Excellent. What is philosophy? How would you describe it?
Yeah, so I think it's actually really hard to describe what philosophy is. And I start the book with a story about me coming home after I like spent a day in this philosophy class. And I spent more than one day, but after I'd sort of decided that like this is what I want to do, a few weeks later I went home and I told my parents, I think I'm going to major in philosophy. And my dad said, "What's that?" And then I realized, oh, I have a problem, because I've been sitting in this class and I really like it and I have no idea how to describe what it is. So I started to like, I was like, maybe I'll show him if I can't tell him. I was like, well, you know, maybe. Like, we think we're sitting here eating dinner together in this restaurant, but actually someone stole our brains and put them in a vat and hooked them up to electrodes. And we just, and like, they're stimulating so that we think we're having dinner, but we're actually not. And he looked at me with horror. He's like, first question was like, he's like, can they do that? And I'm like, I don't think so, but that's not the question. The question is, how do we know they didn't? And that's when he looked at me kind of with horror, and he's like, "That's what you want to study?" and I very quickly said, "Well, the department has lots of logic classes too." And he said, "I hope you take those." It was kind of my first interaction with my parents about my chosen profession. But I was just confused for years. How do you explain what philosophy is? And then my older son, Rex, in second grade, his teacher asked all the kids on the first day, they say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And they sent home a list, and they didn't like match up the list with particular kids, but you could spot his easily. He said he wanted to be a math philosopher.
Right.
So I said, "Hey, buddy, you know, your teacher says you want to be a math philosopher. What's philosophy?" And just instantly he says, "Philosophy is the art of thinking."
Ah.
And I think that's a really great way to think about it. Like, a philosophical question is a question like about ourselves or about the world that we make progress on by thinking about it deeply, right? So like there's like some questions that are like scientific. We need to get out with our experiments or our observations and explore the world. But then there's other questions like, what is justice or fairness or what's the best way to live, right? The only way we're going to make progress on questions like that is to think about them deeply. I think that's what philosophy is about.
Yeah, it always bugs me with children how we spend all our time saying, pay attention, concentrate, and we should let them just wander off, shouldn't we? Their minds should be able to go off and think about things and explore. And I think that's in your book what's very apparent. I think your books, by the way, is a great way of actually entertaining thought processes and thinking about things, because it's sometimes seen through the eyes of a child. It sort of really opens it up to get you thinking about it. But do you think that we sometimes tell our children to, you know, this is the way it is, rather than letting them explore?
Yeah, so I think that schools definitely are sort of marching through curriculums. I don't know if you have the same problem.
Yep.
There that we have over here, but here everyone's like teaching to get the kids ready for the test.
Yep.
Right. And the test is the way of assessing the school. And so like, there's very little time to say to the kids, "Hey, what are you interested in?" Or like, what are you thinking about today? And actually, here's like another parenting hack. I realized, like, if I ask my kids at the end of the day, "What did you learn in school today?" I just get back like nothing, or like not even an answer, just like a grunt. But if I say to them, "Hey, what are you wondering about? What are you thinking about?" I often can have interesting conversations with them that are not about what they talked about in school, but you find out like what's going on in their mind. So I do think like formal schooling wise, we have that problem. And then also, you know, I think even just like parents' interactions with their kids, I was on a parenting podcast over here recently, and there was a father who had written in to say, like, I'm just overwhelmed by my child's questions. And like, you know, some of the deep questions they ask, and I try to answer as many as I can, but you know, sometimes I just I'm exhausted. And I actually thought part of the problem in that situation is the father's view that he has to answer the questions.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So it
goes back to what you were saying earlier, like, let's have a conversation. What do you think? How could we go about solving this problem? It relieves you of some of the burden of knowing the answers, because you don't.
My biggest problem I have with school, and I don't know if it's the same over there, but we do this thing called homework over here. And I always think with adults, one of the biggest problems with jobs is when you don't know where there's an end to them. So I always say this, my mate is air traffic control. And when he finishes work, there's nothing he can do to land a plane. So he switches off. And I always think that job is so beautiful because you can only work when you're at work. And when you leave and that's it. Whereas jobs like mine or yours or a lot of people out there, you can take it home with you. And then it's really frustrating because it's like, how many podcasts can I write? How much can I read of more of your book? How much, you know, it's like this whole endless sort of time where I don't know when my job actually finishes. That's why I like live TV, actually, because it starts and it stops and that's it, you know. And we do this with our children. We send them home with this timeless project where we go home, and they hate it. That's my phone going off. They absolutely hate it. And yet, when my child comes home and I say, hey, should we invent a shop today? Or should we think of an idea for a TV show or a magazine? She'll spend hours with me doing that, which is kind of like homework because it's exciting for her. And there is an end when she's bored of it. But with actual homework. And so I really think it's a bad idea for us to be doing this. And you know what? If schools can't do what they need to deliver in 6 hours, God knows what they're doing, because children can't keep learning after 6 hours. So, you know, it's a bit of a problem. I find that with our schools. I don't know if you have the same thing over there.
You know, we do. They're getting better at it for the younger kids. My, my kids are now 9 and 12, and the 9-year-old nearly never brings home homework, but the 12-year-old is starting to. And I feel what you're saying really deeply. It's actually one of the challenges of being a philosopher is like the questions get stuck in your head, and you can and you do just think of them all the time. And sometimes I'm having dinner with my family and they'll say that I've gone to Scotland, like because it's clear that like I've left the conversation and I'm working through the trolley problem or working through like some other question in philosophy. And often I don't even notice that I'm doing it. So I am with you, jealous of jobs that just can't be done anywhere else. And I think I agree, like we should give our kids those jobs. Let them be kids for a large chunk of the day.
Yeah, definitely. Right. So something which is always stuck in my mind, and I'm going to ask you about this, is law. It's just a bit of a con, isn't it, law? We're told by society that law is black and white. And the reality is law is nothing like that. You get the justice you pay for, especially in America. You know, you can murder someone and get off with it if you've got enough cash. And law is definitely aimed for the poor. Over here, we have a situation where our politicians can set laws, and then they break them and then call them rules rather than laws to try and make it so it's not as bad. No, I broke the rules, I know, and I'm sorry about that. No, you broke the law. But the word law, I've been through family law courts and stuff, because it's not black and white at all. It's interpretation constantly. And also, punishments are also not black and white either. Again, it's interpretation. So it's a bit of a con we've all bought into, do you not think?
So I think that there are good things and bad things about law. And you're putting your finger on some of the things that are both bad about it and some of the things that are frustrating about it. So it's certainly true over here that we have real problems with access to justice. The more money you have, the easier it is to get in court, to get high-powered lawyers that are going to do a good job for you. But that's a bad feature of the system. Like, here's a kind of counterpoint. Just, I teach tort law, which is, say, a lot of injuries, accidents, or just interpersonal wrongdoing. So like you punch me in the face and I sue you. And I think it's actually one of the great achievements of modern society that anybody can bring a tort suit against anybody else, right? So like if you go back even just a few hundred years in England, right, like the aristocracy is not answerable to commoners, right? Whereas like the present state of the law is, hey, look, if the really wealthy guy crashes into your car and damages it, you can take him to court, sue him for, over here we would call it trespass to chattel, you can get compensation for it. And so I do think that law can, at its best, play this kind of leveling equality function. It's just that it too often doesn't. Like the second bit of what you said, like the it's not black and white, it's a lot of interpretation, that's just true. You know, like I think a lot of people think, oh, I want to find out what the law is, I'm just going to look it up in some book. And it's often more complicated because you'll find a rule which has some ambiguity in it, or you'll find decisions in cases that are sort of like yours, but not exactly like yours. And it takes some expertise to figure out what's going to happen in my case.
Yeah. I want to, just before we go on, so I want to talk about, revenge in a minute, because that's a really good bit of your book I enjoyed. But just before that, it's interesting with law, though, because your suing culture you have over there has worked its way over here. And the problem with it is I go to a hospital and get misdiagnosed. That doctor has not got up that morning and gone, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to misdiagnose Tim so he dies or he gets a horrible illness. Yeah. Yet my reaction to it is I'm going to sue someone for money. The money bit, we should take the money bit out of it somehow, because as soon as you're putting a financial reward on it, then people go, I'm going to sue, I'm going to get money and I'm going to sue them. The other side of that is the stress you are adding to these people who are already stressed because they have to make decisions. Now they can't make a wrong decision. So now we've got a medical system that whatever you go in with, they say, I'll test you for everything. Because they're too scared to make it a wrong decision. Otherwise, they're going to get sued. Not that they will pay. The NHS will pay, which means I'm paying. The tax will pay. And then the doctor might get struck off. So with that culture comes a sort of fear as well, a terror of people's jobs constantly. So there's plus and minuses of that sort of culture.
You're exactly right about that. And I'm actually disappointed to hear that our litigious culture is migrating across the ocean. Because one thing I always try and remind people about the States is we don't have the NHS. We don't have universal health care. So there's when you're injured here, often you're in a position of needing to sue in order to get the medical care that you need. Or if you happen to have health insurance, then sometimes it's your health insurance insisting that you sue so they can get reimbursed for the money they paid out for you. And so I always think people are really critical of Americans for suing a lot, failing to realize that part of what's going on here is sometimes that's the only way to get access to the resources you need for your medical care. But you're also right that like no doctor wakes up thinking, hey, I'm going to make a mistake today. Maybe not no doctor, right? You know, yeah. Maybe some of them are drunk on the job and ought to be held accountable for that. And so I think like there are pockets of the world where maybe we should think there's probably a better way to respond to these kinds of accidents than suing each other. But I think there's other places in the world where, you know, like think about Boeing and the corners it cut in the design of the 737 MAX plane. I don't know if that's news over there the way it's news over here. They like to save money and make the certification of their planes easier. They made some choices that ended up making the planes vulnerable to crashing in certain situations. And it was a kind of calculation on their part of like not being like of putting kind of the profits before safety. And I do think in those kinds of cases, there ought to be a mechanism for this interpersonal accountability. Like one person goes to, like the victims go to court and they say, hey, you owed us better than this. And yeah, we have an airing of what happened. And then a court pronounces whether or not, you know, Boeing is responsible.
Yeah. I don't want to draw you on this too much because I don't want to get you into trouble when it's something. But are you aware that the rest of the world, being a philosopher, looks at America and sees the fact that you don't have healthcare for your people and the fact that you're so obsessed with keeping owning guns is just in for the rest of the world. We all look over at you and go, this is like supposed to be the most powerful country. It's got the biggest thinkers. It's created so much stuff. And yet the very, very simple solutions for us over in Europe, where we all have, you know, and even Canada, where we have healthcare and people don't have guns. And yet America is stuck. They've somehow got themselves stuck. As a philosopher, it must be quite fascinating watching people seem to be damaging themselves. It's kind of like self-harming in America.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of Americans share the view you're describing of that people in other countries have of us and have like a deep frustration about our political system, which I think is actually over time becoming less and less democratic, right? So we're saddled with this antiquated system through the Electoral College for selecting a president, where it's not actually people's votes ultimately that are determining the outcome, at least not the popular count of people's votes. And we're saddled with a kind of like, I don't know if you call it gerrymandering over there, like the way the districts are drawn. It's more that politicians are choosing their voters rather than voters are choosing their politicians. And so there's, I think you'd actually get like a large number of Americans would, you know, especially this week, support significant gun control measures. A large number of Americans would like to see universal access to healthcare. And I think we're stymied by two things. One is the political system, and the other is a kind of frayed society where a lot of people are, if things are going well for them, are not willing to help others. And I think that's how you end up in a world where it strikes people as sensible that we pay our own way for our healthcare rather than take care of each other.
You seem to have a real problem over there. We do over here, by the way, but it's with status and power. And status and power is very much financially rewarded, and how many sort of, you know, like if you work your way up high in business or government, and that can be at the, you know, someone like Jeff Bezos, I find fascinating that he's got more money than anything, and yet his staff don't like working for him. I mean, Jesus Christ, like, why wouldn't you want to be the greatest boss in the world? Why wouldn't you want everybody to go, I want to work for Amazon? That's the job for me. He's got enough money that he could filter that all down and make his employees the best, like Google did. You know, made it the best place in the world to work, you know, and I'm so astonished by that. But clearly his driver is money and going to space and beating Elon Musk and Warren Buffett and all that lot. This sort of huge status thing of, well, I want to be the richest person in the world type weird stuff going on.
Yeah. And I, you know, like, I just think in a society, we ought to be looking for ways to make things work for everybody. But then I find the same thing you do striking. Why, if you're like one of these captains of industry with more money than you could ever possibly spend in your lifetime, why wouldn't you say, hey, like everyone that's involved in making this company go, we're all going to reap the benefits of it. There's still going to be plenty for you. He could still be one of the wealthiest people in the world and pay his workers well and give them bathroom breaks. It's just kind of wild. I think part of the problem is they see their workers, they're so far removed from them, and I think they see their workers as like economic assets to exploit. So like, how can we get the most out of them in the most efficient way, in the same way they might see like their fleet of trucks, right, as an economic asset to exploit. And what gets lost is that they're people with lives and families, that they're not just resources that you maximize the value of.
So the great philosophers from, I don't know, Buddhism, Christianity, the Stoics, all of them would say that's a terrible place they've put themselves in, and it's not how to live your life, and it's not a healthy way to live your life. Have we lost the ancient philosophy somewhere along the line? Where do you think that happened, where people lost the sort of the way to live your life in a healthy way for the whole of society?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a historian, so I'm reluctant to speculate. My suspicion is that there was no like fall from grace, which is to say that the thinkers you're talking about were probably on the periphery of their societies, right, in a way too, right? That they weren't like, those societies weren't organized in accord with their principles.
Okay.
So that would be my guess. I mean, on the particular question we were just talking about, my Michigan colleague, Elizabeth Anderson, has a super cool book called Private Government. She's been trying to persuade people for years that the most oppressive government most of us interact with is actually not the state. Although, you know, for some people in the world it is, but for those of us lucky enough to live in liberal democracies, it's not the state, it's usually your employer, right? That they've got like more or less, at least in the states where you can be fired at will, they've got more or less total control over your life. So Amazon can say to people things like, we're going to search your belongings on the way in and the way out, and we're going to time your bathroom breaks, yeah, and, you know, and work you like to the point where you're suffering like serious health problems. And then we just cast you aside and get somebody new in that role. And, you know, like we tolerate behavior from our employers that we would never tolerate from the government, or like, so like we've got like over here, our protections against unreasonable search and seizures, like a police officer can't just, you know, ask to look in my backpack, but my employer could be like, hey, you're fired unless you open up your backpack. Wow. Yeah. And so she actually does in that book, in addition to thinking about what we could do to change things, she does uncover some of the history of how that came to be. So if you're interested in that stuff, it's a really good read.
Okay. I'll give that a go. Do you know her? Can you get her on the podcast?
I know her and I think we could arrange that.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, ask for you. Right, I want to get onto your book because I want people to consider buying your book because I think it's really good. And one of the bits I love was revenge, because revenge just feels like it's just a sentence or a one word. And there's so many different aspects to revenge. And your book got me really thinking about it. Should we start with how the conversation came with, if you remember, with your children about revenge, and then we can go into a few of the little bits? Yeah. Because it also, yeah, go on, tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so this is actually one of my favorite like stories in the book and memories of my kids. So one day when my youngest Hank was 3, he didn't have school that day, and so he and I were just sort of like hanging out, snuggling in bed, and all of a sudden he got really serious, and he says to me, "Yesterday, Caden," that's like a kid in his class, "Caden called me a floofer-doofer, and then the teacher came to talk to me. And I said, well, did she talk to Caden too? And he said, no, pretty indignantly. She's like, she just talked to me. It's like, well, why'd she talk to you? Did you tell her what Caden did? And he said, not until after. And I'm like, well, not after what, buddy? I could not get him to tell me what had happened. But it was quite clear at some point. I said, Hank, did you think it was okay to do something mean to Caden because he said something mean to you? And he looked at me like I was stupid. And he's like, yes, he called me a floofer doofer. And so, you know, I just started, like, I just got really interested in this. Like, it struck him as just completely obvious that if somebody did something that that was mean to him, that he should do something mean back. And actually, like, that resonated with some of the torts cases that I teach. I teach this case from 1872 where one guy spits on another guy, and then the guy who got spit on sues him for battery. And he gets what was, for the time, a kind of astronomical damage award, $1,000 in 1872, which is, depending on how you think about it, maybe as much as like an income of a $250,000 now. And then the damage award is appealed, and the Illinois Supreme Court upholds the award, and they say, we need to make these liberal damages available so as to save the necessity of resort to private violence. I'm like, well, that's an interesting thing. Like, the necessity, like the picture they've got and the picture my little kid has got is, if somebody wrongs you, right, you must strike back somehow. And so the chapter in the book is an effort to figure out, like, what is it you would get out of striking back? What is it you're after? Do you really get it? And then, well, is there any other way that we could help you get that doesn't involve, like, me putting your eye out when you put my eye out?
The two things I thought about that were, which really got me thinking, and the major one was, which you talk about, is the deterrent. Now, obviously, Putin at the moment is sitting there bragging about his nukes and his nuclear weapons. If he doesn't think we're going to revenge, if we've become such an advanced society that revenge is considered not a go-to option, then he can press the button willy-nilly because we're not going to revenge. And sadly, well, not sadly, but there's a lot of politicians out there who are speaking that language, which is slightly worrying, because even if you're got no intention of revenge, you've still got to say you are. Otherwise, there's nothing stopping a bully from doing it. And you talk about bullying in the book and stuff like that. And it really made me think about that unless revenge is an important part of life. And the other side of it is, I listened to a podcast once with, so I can't remember who it was now, some some academics discussing it, and they said that the you get a wonderful feeling from revenge. Apparently, people quite like it, and that's why people used to go and watch hangings, and in France they like chopping guillotines, chopping people's heads, and people used to turn up and watch it. Now our appetite for that sort of stuff is no longer there, but people used to like it because they felt good that they were getting revenge on the bad people in society. So. Is there something like that? Is there a good feeling about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, the deterrence point you make just strikes me as correct, right? So you think of just like, take it back to Hank for a moment. You know, when the kid calls him a floofer-doofer, and we did actually have a funny conversation. I was like, what's a floofer-doofer? And he said, Daddy, it's bad. And I was like, I don't know, maybe a floofer-doofer is good. Should we Google it? But he was very insistent, and rightly so, that even though it's a meaningless phrase, you somehow know that it's awful to have been called a floofer-doofer. And so here he is, having been called this ridiculous thing, and he knows that he needs to respond in some way. Otherwise, he's communicating that it's okay for you to call me this. There's not going to be any consequence for you. So, like, it's self-protective sometimes, seeking revenge. And I do think that, like, one line that our leaders have to walk in the conflict with Putin is letting him know that if he crosses, say, the nuclear line, it's not going to go well for him. And I do think, like, I think they're in a difficult spot because, like, if they rattle their sabers too much and he thinks that we might strike first, then he's got a reason to go first. So I think they've, you know, I don't envy the position they're in figuring out just how you send the message without sending too strong a message. But I think you're right to pick up on that dynamic in the situation. There is a lot of research, actually, that suggests that taking revenge makes us feel good. In fact, like, they put people on an MRI machine and it seems to, like, light up the part of your brain that lights up when your appetites are satisfied. So, like, this old Homeric line that revenge is sweet seems to have some basis in our biology. And one suspects that, like, we've been kind of, like, evolutionarily wired up to take some pleasure in it because it's costly, right? So like, we are wired up to take this internal pleasure so that we'll be willing to do the thing that's either protective of ourselves or protective of the group that we're a part of.
Yeah, though, interestingly, as you point out in your book as well, and we know for a fact that if you do nothing, if you're like a stoic and you can go, nothing anybody does has any impact on me, you will actually probably be happier in the long run if you can just look at, like, sticks and stones you mentioned in the book. And as long as it's not violent towards you, anybody says anything to you, a floofer-doofer or whatever, and you go, right, I just don't care, as you point out, you know, that's one of the worst things you can do is say, your opinion doesn't matter to me. And I always think this, I've mentioned on the podcast before, that your superpower is if you do nothing. We've all seen it, because at the time you feel furious, but a day later, an hour later, a week later, you feel amazing that you didn't react to something. It's like it's living in the future, basically, by doing nothing at that stage. Yeah. So, but then if we all felt that way, then the Putins of this world will think, okay, they're just going to ignore me, so I might as well press the button. So it's like it's a complicated issue, isn't it? Revenge.
It is. So I've been really helped in my thinking about this by another colleague, William Ian Miller, who's maybe like the world's leading expert on revenge and honor cultures. And he says, like, look, it's a mark of your status that you can ignore what like slights from other people. Right. So, you know, we talked a little while ago about how, like, there was a, you know, period in English history where, like, the aristocracy just weren't answerable to commoners. And I think that was a bad feature of the law, but it was part of what established the hierarchy between them. Like you're so insignificant, that we're not going to be, we can't be, actually the aristocracy could shoot commoners, but, like, they often just wouldn't bother. Like we're not bothered by what you're doing to us because you don't count in a kind of way. Right. So Miller says it's kind of like a power move that you can make to be like, you're so insignificant that your attempts to injure me don't even land, right? And so I teach my kids, right, try and pull that off, right? You know, like this line that I taught them, like, you know, like somebody said something insulting to you, try saying, I don't care what you think. It's a way of trying to like raise you above them without having responded to them. The challenge, as you point out with Putin, is actually we do care what he thinks and what he does, more centrally about what he does. So you can only make this power move if you actually got the power in the relationship and you're not in a position of having to care. Mm. So because he's got these weapons, we actually, he can injure us. And so we have to take that possibility seriously.
A lot of life is about status. Interesting you mentioned in the book about Taylor Swift suing someone for a pound. And it occurred to me that whilst I'm reading that, Depp and Amber Heard are busy in court making themselves look absolutely ridiculous and you know what the problem with that case is? I have literally no idea what it's about. All I can see is two people of high profile wasting money going, he did this, she did that. No. I'm not saying none of it was like horrific for them and there might have been abuse or whatever. Yeah. I literally have no idea why they're in court and it's being played out because I don't know who's brought the case on who or anything because it just hasn't interested me. But I do see hear some of it and go, oh, there's Kate Moss doing it now or whatever. And I'm thinking, what are all these people doing? It's absolutely insane. They need to sit down with a mediator or something because neither of them are getting anything out of it.
Well, you know, Taylor Swift, I feel like, actually gave me a gift when she filed that. Well, so she wasn't the initial person to file a lawsuit in that conflict. So let me just like bring you up to speed on what that was about. So so she had a radio appearance. I think the guy was like a Denver radio host and they posed for some pictures beforehand. And she said that he groped her, that he grabbed her butt. And he was fired in the aftermath of that. And then he sued her for defamation saying, hey, what you said was false. I didn't grab your butt. And she responded by countersuing. She brought a claim for battery. She's like, actually, you did grab my butt and that's not okay. And she asked for just $1 in damages. And when I say she gave me a gift, it's because I've long been trying to persuade my students that, yeah, plaintiffs care about the money, especially, say, the plaintiffs we were talking about earlier who need to pay for their healthcare. But they often care about other things too. And actually, sometimes they care about those other things more, right? So why did Taylor Swift sue and ask for $1 in damages? Well, she asked for the dollar just because like the way the courts are structured, you have to ask for something. But she was essentially asking for nothing because what she cared about was establishing the truth and making clear that like my body's my property. It's not yours. Like, you know, not any man who wants to grab me can grab me. And I think that's actually really important that we have like institutions that are willing to set those norms and make it clear that you need somebody's permission to touch them in that way. And so I think she did a service, like not just for herself, but for all women who men have like reached out and groped by contributing to the culture in which like we collectively say that's not okay. I assume I haven't followed the Depp and Heard stuff. Similarly, I assume the underlying claims, I think it actually did start with he sued her for defamation and now she's suing him for like he said your allegations of domestic abuse were false. And she says, well, you were lying when you say they're false. I haven't quite followed like the details of those claims. But ultimately, even if these processes can be abused or brought in cases that turn out to be frivolous. I'm not saying this one is. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't know enough about it. I think it's important for there to be places where we can go when we've been wronged and say, hey, that's like, you can't treat me like that. It's not okay. And it's important so that we don't have to spit on each other or take violent revenge.
True. Though I wonder if the people who win out of it just is the lawyers who are spending an absolute fortune. I wonder if they could not find a better way of doing it just in an afternoon with a mediator or a judge rather than, well, I suppose that's that's the job of the law, too complicated. Talking about law, but it got me thinking with the revenge and everything about punishment. It's funny how we gauge punishment. In Norway, I'm sure you're aware that a lot of their prisons are really lovely places to go and they believe in rehabilitation and taking criminals who probably are in there because they've had a bad run of things. And because they're not inherently evil, and they try and give them a nice life, And so they come out better people and part of the community. It's a smaller population, I understand, but over in Britain and America, we think punishment should be treat them really badly. And then they come out and they, I don't know the facts, but they often reoffend. Now, I just looked up some figures. Criminals cost us £43,000 a year. I wonder if it'd be better, just as a thought process, to actually say, look, we're not going to put you in prison at all. Say they did a 5-year, but we just let them out and gave them £150,000 instead. And so I said that, and we save ourselves £100,000. And it's like, I know it's a mental idea, but I was just thinking through, because you got me thinking about things differently. And I was thinking, why is somebody in prison? That there's very few white middle class muggers, you know. It's just, yeah. it's you mug because you don't have the money and you haven't had the possibly, you know, the starting place. So I don't know. It's the punishment is a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's a chapter on punishment in the book, which sort of starts with our like first and funny failed attempt to punish our older son Rex, but then like takes it as a springboard to like, what are we trying to accomplish? And eventually arrives at some of these bigger questions that you're asking about punishing adults, not just punishing kids. And I say there, I think we should punish, or we should imprison many fewer people in dramatically better conditions than we do. So many fewer people, I think we use prison, we put a lot of people in prison who maybe committed low-level offenses when they were tired, hungry, stretched thin by like the world, by unemployment or lack of opportunity. And prison's not a long-term solution to that problem. It's just making the situation worse for them, their families, their communities. So I'd like to see us stop using prison that way. I do think that there are like serious crimes for which we do need to hold open the possibility of punishment. So like the cases where, you know, you said like we see mental to say like, oh, let's just give you some cash that will make your life more stable and you'll be less bothersome to us. You know, like I think there might not be cases, there might be cases where that's not a crazy thought, but then you have like these cases of like sexual assault, you know, committed by somebody who had every advantage in life. And you think, well, actually, is this something you're responsible for? We need to find a way of condemning this. We maybe need to find a way of keeping other people safe from you. So
Though you say they have every advantage, but what if their parents were horrific? I'm getting to the point where, yeah. I'm getting to the point, it was really, by the yeah. way, interestingly, that woman who ended up by training her husband in your book by rewarding him rather than criticizing him. I thought that was very good, yeah. and treating him like a dog, and it worked, which was quite amusing.
I think some people commit these crimes out of a sense of entitlement. Like, I don't think everyone that commits sexual assault had a bad upbringing. I think some men in our society just think they're entitled to women's bodies. But I think, but there's also, it's true that like some of the crimes we think are really horrific were committed by people who were treated in just terrible ways as children. So one of my favorite papers in philosophy is by Gary Watson, who teaches at the University of Southern California. And he tells this story in the middle of this paper about just one of the most horrific murders you've ever read about, just like committed in the most callous way possible and really for no reason at all. And you get really outraged reading this story. And you think of the person who would commit a murder like this as being like really kind of a monster. And then a few pages later, he tells you the story of that person's life as a child. And they were like just treated in the most horrific way by their parents, subject to physical and emotional abuse. It's really like if you were to try and imagine the worst childhood you could imagine, and then, you know, amp it up by 50%, like you'd be getting in the ballpark of what this guy had experienced. And at the end of all this, Watson says something really interesting. He says, when I see both of these things, I have trouble forming an overall picture of this human being, because my anger at who he is now and what he did now is competing with my sympathy for the kid that he once was. And so I feel kind of conflicted in how I should respond to him. I want to respond to that little kid who experienced this upbringing in a super sympathetic way. But also I don't want to lose sight of like my need to condemn, like we can't treat each other in the horrific ways that he did as an adult. And I think think that part of being human is just being caught between these, like the fact that we can have these two perspectives on somebody, that you may not be responsible for who you are, right? But you may be responsible for what you did. And we just have to live with both attitudes.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Because Jeffrey Dahmer, I watched a documentary on him once, and his stepdad shot his favorite pony or dog or something in front of him. Mm. And he had a terrible upbringing. And then he turned himself into a serial killer. And they were wondering whether you could connect the dots from his childhood through to turning into a monster like that. I suppose that begs the question, do we have free will? How much of this stuff do we actually decide ourselves, and how much is created for us? I suppose this is, eventually we're going to come to the stage where we're looking at people in prisons in a much more empathetic way. And I wonder if we're going to, as society grows or continues, we're going to start looking at people and say, it's actually not their fault. We need to be able to trace it back to the mechanics which got someone to make those thought processes and turn into whatever. But I suppose it depends your thoughts on free will. I mean, do you think, I mean, we didn't choose our parents. We can't decide whether we're hungry or not. That's not something we can't turn our hearing off. We can't make our liver work. You know, there's very few bits of us that we can actually control. So, you know, how much free will do we actually have? What do you think?
Well, this is one of my favorite conversations to have with my students. They're kind of two competing views in philosophy. There's the people who call themselves compatibilists, and they think, oh yeah, like the world is deterministic, everything operates by the laws of physics, but we can nevertheless have free will within that. And then there's the people who call themselves incompatibilists. They think in order for there to be free will, like we would need to have like space to be the author of our own decisions in the very robust way that they weren't like determined by things that happened in the past. I'm on the compatibilist side of this picture, right? And actually there's a philosopher who passed away a couple of years ago, Judith Jarvis Thompson, who made one of my sort of favorite observations in this space. She said, like, she imagined somebody, she called him David. I don't know, like, if there was like a David in her life who was really bad, but she said, David has like an alphabet soup of vices. He's arrogant. He's a bully. He's a coward, like, and on, like, you know, like, and she says, like, and of course, there's a reason David is this way, right? You know, in his upbringing or his like genetic wiring. But she says that then somebody comes along and they want to tell me, oh, yeah, but David's not a bad person. And she's like, wait a minute, right? Didn't I just tell you that he was arrogant and a bully and on? I'm afraid you don't know what it means to be a bad person. If you think that, you know, just having a history, right, means you're not now a bad person, right? And I think that she was giving voice to this, like to the way I put it earlier, that you don't necessarily have to be responsible for who you are in order to be responsible for what you do. So like, we should tell David, hey, look, not okay to be arrogant that way, not okay to be a bully. Even if we like can look at him and have some understanding of how it is that he came to be arrogant and a bully.
It's so interesting, this subject. Right, I want to move on because we're running out of time, and I want to make sure we talk about another couple of things. So the first thing is, what happens when you get to the edge of the universe?
Oh, yeah. So my older son, Rex, one day, I'm walking him home. He was 7 years old. We're walking home from school, and he tells me that the universe is infinite. And I was like, I don't know, buddy. Like, you know, some scientists say that it's infinite, and some think it's just really, really big, but finite. And he's like, no, it has to be infinite. And I'm like, why do you think so? And so he makes this argument. He says, if you take a spaceship all the way to the end of the universe, and you get there, and then you just kind of punch your hand, and he shows me, like, he's like punches his fist forward. He's like, it has to go somewhere, right? And I was like, I don't know. What if it just stops? And he's like, well, then there'd be something stopping it. So you wouldn't be at the end yet. It was clever. It's actually like, I knew enough. Like I like to read popular physics. So I knew this wasn't actually in the end a good argument, because like you can have a finite space that doesn't have edges. So think of like a balloon and like an ant walking on the surface of a balloon. He's walking on like a finite space, but he never hits an edge because this like the surface folds back on itself. And some scientists think the universe might be like that. Like if you set out in your spaceship and you just kept going, eventually you'd get back to the spot where you started. But I was talking to a philosopher of physics about this a few days later. I was like, hey, my kid made this super cool argument. I don't think it works, but what do you think? And he's like, oh, that argument is like it, like, people have been making that argument for thousands of years. Like, it's credited to this ancient Greek philosopher named Archytas, and then Lucretius, the Roman poet, made the argument. Isaac Newton liked the argument. And so it's just like an illustration of like the central claim of my book. Like, your kids are really smart and clever. And like, this 7-year-old just like was thinking about the size of the universe, and he came up with an argument that Isaac Newton thought was a good argument. So I take that as like, proof of the idea that like kids are really talented philosophers.
I just love that idea. I've got to say, when I was reading that, I love the concept of it, of it just can't end. And then that got me thinking about time, because we're so obsessed with a beginning and an end. And I suppose that's because we, in our world, we live and die. And I suppose that's why we perceive it. And there's always this thing, when did the world start? And it's like, why does it have to? When does it end? Yeah. Why does it have to end? It's because we can only comprehend that. And yet the reality is, as soon as you leave the planet, time changes. But time does, we've proven you leave the planet and time's different up there than it is on here. So our concept of time is weird anyway. It's kind of, but that's why I love all this stuff. You start thinking about time. Have you got any thoughts on time?
Oh, yeah, I don't know if we have time for my thoughts on time. I was at a dinner party once. I had given a talk at UCLA, and the host invited me over for dinner, and she said, I invited a philosopher of time over. I hope you don't mind. And I was like, are you kidding? I've got a lot of questions about time, some of which, are your questions about, like, does it have to have a beginning? Does it have to have an end? Some are questions about time travel. So, we could probably have a whole nother conversation about time.
I did that not so long ago, and with a cosmologist on this podcast, and he started talking about what do you call them? Duplicate universes and multiverses and things like that. My brain was going, but it sort of all made sense to me, which is like the thing we started with, is this all a dream we're living? I suppose before we end the podcast, we should go back to the trolley experiment, because that was something that I thoroughly enjoyed. It's a great thought process, isn't it? So could you just remind us of it, and then I'll give you my views.
Yeah, so the trolley problem, a lot of people, I'm going to tell you like the first story, a lot of people think that's the trolley problem, but actually you need two stories to get the trolley problem going. So the standard story that has penetrated most people's consciousness now runs like this. There's an out of control trolley heading down a track, and there are 5 workers up ahead on the track, and if nothing is done, it's going to hit those workers and kill them. But you just happen to be standing near a switch. You can pull the switch and divert it onto a different piece of track, and that'll save those 5 workers. But bad news, there's 1 worker on the spur, on the additional piece of track. And so if you pull the switch, that worker's going to die, but you'll save the other 5. And so most people, not you, Tim, I know, but most people think, I'm gonna pull that switch and save the 5, even though the 1's going to die. So that's case 1. Now, case 2, you can do in a variety of ways. It's most commonly done through a version of the story called Fat Man. So out of control trolley heading down the track, it's going to kill 5 workers. This time you're not near a switch, you're on a bridge overlooking the situation. There's a very heavy man who's leaning against the railing. If you just give him a little tip, he's going to fall over. And you believe, why I don't know, but you believe, you know, that if you push him, he'll fall on the track. It'll stop. His body will stop the trolley. He's going to die in the collision, but it'll save those 5 workers further on. And then you ask people, hey, would you push the man over the bridge? And most people, like Simon on the Sunday brunch, say, no, I would pull the switch, but I'm not going to push the man. And that's the trolley problem. The problem is, why, when the math is the same, kill 1 person to save 5, are we getting inconsistent answers about what people would do in these situations?
So I woke up the next day and I text Simon and say, how did you feel about murdering someone yesterday?
What did he say?
Well, we ended up in a whole conversation about it again. And I said, and you know who you murdered, don't you? And he said, who? And I said, that one person was the person who had the cure for cancer. And he was,
oh no.
Yeah, he was going to save billions of lives, and yet you killed him. And the people you saved, by the way, the 5 you saved were Hitler, Putin, Genghis Khan. By the way, they were all sitting there. You killed all the, you saved all the bad people who went on to cause massive atrocities, and yet you killed the good guy.
When my kids made, like, you know, I invited some students over. We did like a class at my house, and we talked about the trolley problem, and my kids made it out of their toy train set, and they put stormtroopers from Star Wars on the line. And I do think, like, depending on who these people are they stormtroopers? Are they Putin? Like, you can change the calculus. It starts to look a little different. But one thing I think you'll find interesting is, so like the sort of, the progenitors of the trolley problem, like the very first appearance of trolleys in philosophy was from an English philosopher named Philippa Foot. But then this American who I mentioned earlier, Judith Jarvis Thompson, she's the person that really made it famous. She put these two stories in their canonical forms and made clear that, like, the problem here is our inconsistent judgments. But then maybe like 30 years later, towards the end of her life, she wrote a paper and she says, wait a minute, I think I kicked off this conversation. Millions of articles have been written about it, but I think I had it wrong. And she kind of took your view. She's like, maybe the mistake is thinking that it's okay to pull the lever. So I think most people are still giving these inconsistent answers, but maybe the most important figure in the trolley problem conversation adopted your view in the end.
Yeah, I just think it's the idea that you're going to murder someone. And if you interfere, my thought process was, if you interfere, then you don't know anything about these people. You don't know anything about the consequences. You're pulling it. You are the one. It's your action now, which is killing someone. Whereas your inaction, you're not killing anyone. It's an accident. And that, to me, seemed to be, that's nothing to do with me. I don't want to murder someone, but I'm just going to witness a horrific accident.
Philippa Foot's original version of the story tried to close off the thought that you're having by putting you on the trolley rather than at a switch on the side. She made you the trolley driver.
Okay, right.
And actually, this is how it appears in The Good Place too. So you're driving the trolley and your brakes have gone, and you can switch it onto the different track or you can let it keep going. And so she wanted to set up the story, so you're going to kill someone either way, like you're driving. Should it be five or should it be one? What do you want to do in that circumstance?
I suppose you go for one then. I suppose that makes sense. You're involved. You're involved. What's interesting about this experiment is, I don't know if you're aware, there was an experiment years later where they were pretending to electrocute people and people actually doing it. Do you remember that? I'm sorry, my memory's very sketchy of it. But people were actually electrocuting.
The Milgram experiments. Yeah.
How did those ones work?
So now we're testing my memory too.
Sorry.
But it was basically like these people were the subjects of the experiment were brought into a room and they were told that if they like pushed a button, it was going to deliver electric shock to somebody who was like, they could see, but that person was sitting in another room. I forget exactly why they were told to do this, but like they kept saying it's going to start with a small shock and it's going to get a little bigger and a little bigger. And when they would show some hesitation, the psychologist running the experiment would say, actually, no, like, you agreed to do this and we need you to continue. And even just that, like, that small display of authority was getting people to administer what they believed to be extraordinarily painful shocks. There were actors on the other end acting like they were in excruciating pain. They weren't actually in any pain whatsoever because it was a setup. But you know, a lot of people talk about that, those experiments in connection with like complicity with acts of atrocity, sort of like, you know, as you saw in Nazi Germany, just how easy it is to get people to go along with horrific things by displaying a little bit of authority.
It's amazing, isn't it? Humans are so, that's why I say about free will, that we're so malleable by just something weird happening. We sort of, you know, how that happened in for the Second World War is, none of us can look at it and believe it actually happened, can we? But you can always make yourself feel more superior, as you say, than other people. Yeah. And then it starts.
So there's a lot of conversation in philosophy about what people call moral luck. So this question is like, what role does luck play in our moral appraisals of each other? And one source of luck we were talking about earlier, there's like the luck of your, like the way you're wired up and the social circumstances in which you find yourself. Are you born rich or are you born poor? But then there's like this other component of luck. People think of like circumstantial luck. You know, like I wasn't born into Nazi Germany. And so I don't know whether had I been born into those circumstances, I would have been the kind of person, actually, I would have been the kind of person in the concentration camp. But since I'm Jewish, but like I haven't been born in places where I've had the opportunity to be complicit or to resist atrocities. And so, you know, it's easy for people to feel smug. I wouldn't do that. But it's like these experiments provide us a helpful reminder that actually we should be really unsure of ourselves and just how deeply good we are.
Yeah, well, we noticed over here during the pandemic how quickly everybody changed their personalities. We had people, you know, I've used this expression, grassing up their neighbors for, you know, for coming out or having too many people around their house. And, you know, we had to, you know, very much like, the authority suddenly were flying drones because humans were walking in fields and stuff. The police over here and the police were breaking into people's houses very quickly turned into that because of the pandemic. Mm. And I mean, I personally was quite horrified by it, but there was a lot of support for this sort of action where the police suddenly had all these new powers and control. And then it turns out that the people who were running the country, I don't know if you know this, they were busy having parties whilst we were whilst we were doing that. And as I say earlier, they changed it from laws to rules. So they broke rules like it was at school rather than they broke laws. It's all very strange how humans play out. It's fascinating.
Yeah, you know, you guys had much stricter lockdowns and it sounds like some bad behavior in the policing of them. We had much weaker lockdowns, but we discovered something else terrible about each other. Like, you know, a lot of people that are just unwilling to take like the most basic steps to protect their fellow human beings. So the people who are like going into grocery stores and refusing to wear masks and seeing it as like a marker of their personal freedom, when really it's, you know, it's just a complete lack of empathy or care about the people that you might injure. So I think that you know, these difficult circumstances revealed a lot of bad things about our societies.
Yeah, humans are amazing. Scott, I wish I could sign up to one of your classes. It sounds just fun if you sit and talk about this stuff all day long. I'd love to do that. I might put myself on a philosophy course because I love talking about these things. They're fascinating, aren't they? In fact, I was thinking, whilst we were talking this, I was thinking, why don't they have philosophy classes in very, you know, young schools, in the primary schools over here? I'm not sure what you call them over there, but why don't they have philosophy to get the children thinking early? It'd be a really good idea, wouldn't it?
I think it'd be phenomenal. There is a movement. It's actually more advanced over there than it is over here, called Philosophy for Children. And I think there's a lot of benefits. One is you'd help kids hold on to their wonder at the world and their willingness to think things through. I also think we could address a lot of our societal problems if we got kids accustomed to listening to each other and, you know, set some norms about debate, trying to understand each other, to have arguments even with people that you disagree with, but to have them civilly. I think there would be a lot of benefits to having philosophy in our schools.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more genuinely than someone going, telling me something and I go, I've changed my mind on that. I love it because it's suddenly you see a light and you go, oh God, you're right. Yeah, I've been thinking like route A all the time and it's actually route B. I mean, I love all that stuff. Anyway, Scott, thank you so much for joining me. Final question I've got for you. What is the meaning of life?
Oh, wow. a big question to end with. So I think that that there's no meaning of life, but that we can find meaning in our lives. Brilliant. And there's lots of different ways to do it. Family, friends, projects that make the world a better place. So I don't think in the big scheme of things, the universe cares that much about us or that there's a reason we're here, but we can make our own reasons and we should.
That's the way to go, isn't it? Definitely. So listen, thank you so much. I was just checking. Was it Carl Jung who said is it four different stages of life or something? Was it his theory? You go from, I don't know, to I can't even remember them. I wish I hadn't started the conversation now, but when people get problems is when they're stuck in one day. I'll do something on it anyway. There you go. But I was reading all about those the other day. Or was it?
I think of philosophy as being stuck with the questions that little kids have. So
perfect.
I'm glad to be stuck.
Your book, Nasty, Brutish, and Short Adventures in Philosophy with Kids, is out right now. I thoroughly recommend it because it really gets you thinking. If people want to follow you, where's the best place to do it?
On Twitter, it's S. Hershovitz.
S. Hershovitz. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Scott. Thank you.